spend all of our time spanking the monkey like, well, monkeys, we will miss out on the diverse human connections that lead to the sex we really want, and we will find ourselves falling victim to the principle of hedonic tolerance, whereby the more of something pleasurable you experience, the less pleasure you will take from it with each successive experience. Hedonic tolerance happens with everything: sex, drugs, food, extreme sports. The first year you started drinking alcohol, it made you feel better than it does now. Eating ice cream for the first time in a while is better than finding yourself at the bottom of a Ben and Jerry's pint for the 11th day in a row. If you are masturbating constantly, not only will you diminish the amount of enjoyment you experience from the act itself, but you'll diminish the joy of sex too. A tour of online support group message boards for sex addicts and their horrifying stories of endless pornography consumption and marathon masturbation sessions is all you need to know that the key is all things in moderation, including moderation and masturbation. Better sex. The key to better sex is not in the Kama Sutra, though it's a pretty good read. It's not some proprietary sexual position you can only learn by attending a love doctor's seminar at an airport hotel. In fact, it's only partially related to the act itself. The majority of the pathway to better sex lies in the quality of your interactions with a potential partner, all the way up to the point that sex occurs. Better attraction. When you break it down, physical attraction is really nothing more than a genetic and immune system assessment. Our bodies instinctively scan the bodies of those around us and produce an instant Maury Povich response. You cannot be the father, based typically on the presence of healthy genetics and differing acquired immune characteristics. And while this process might start off with the eyes, using symmetry and bodily health as the big visual cues, it ends up with the nose, thanks to the power of pheromones. Pheromones are a chemo signal that translates your immune system profile into a scent, designed to attract mates with different coverage than your own and repel those with similar characteristics. In a study conducted on 100 college students, women were asked to smell the t-shirts worn by a variety of men. The women were demonstrably more attracted to men who had a different acquired immune system than them, while those with similar traits were described more like a brother or a father. The evolutionary advantage of this mechanism is fairly obvious. Not only does this help prevent incest, it increases the survival rate of the child by breeding more robust immune coverage. We have a problem, though. We modern humans mask our scents with perfectly engineered deodorants, antiperspirants, perfumes, lotions, and body sprays. This confuses our natural attraction system and sets us up for a random chance at attraction when we get down to places where you can't hide the smell anymore. If you're one of those unfortunate souls whose milkshake keeps bringing all the wrong boys or girls to the yard, you might want to consider going easy on the colognes and perfumes and scented lotions. Better communication. Let me tell you the most important, game-changing, life-altering way you can use your tongue to improve your sex life. To make words and use them to talk with your partner about sex. Why is it so hard to talk about sex? To talk, as Salt and Peppa said, about you and she and all the good things and the bad things that may be? Well, for one, all those bad things are a minefield of insecurities. She says, "I like it when you touch me this way." And he thinks, "Oh, so you haven't liked how I touched you all those other times?" So let's just set things straight. Everyone is different. Everyone likes different things. No matter how skilled you are or think you are as a lover, you will never truly know your partner unless you communicate. What are their desires, fantasies, boundaries, insecurities? What are yours? We all just need to relax a little bit and lay it out there on the table. Maybe you aren't into the same things, maybe you are. But if you shame your partner into lying to you about what gets them off, they are way more likely to do it behind your back. Creating an honest discourse is absolutely vital, But it's not just communicating with our partner that matters. We have to be willing to communicate in general. You gotta take sex out of the closet for it to bloom into its full potential. Open up about it. Talk to your friends. And if your friends are uptight, listen to podcasts. Dr. Chris Ryan and Dan Savage both produce great sex podcasts. Make it as regular a discussion as your conversations about food, sports, politics, the weather. You might learn a thing or two, or 12. Like Larry Flint famously said, relax, it's just sex. Better Polarity. Despite panning from all the critics for its shallow, predictable storyline and flat characters, the erotic power exchange novel 50 Shades of Grey sold more books than all the Harry Potter series combined. The popularity of what was once thought of as fringe sexuality went full mainstream. Why? Because it was about polarity, and polarity is sexy. The metaphor comes from the idea of a magnet in which there are two sides. Both sides are equally powerful, but the magnet will only be attracted to its opposite polarity and repelled by the same. One of the reasons that power exchange is so exciting is that it exaggerates polarity. Take Mr. Gray, the young, physically perfect, controlling billionaire in the novel. He represents a very dominant polarity. Take Anna, the shy, demure, almost virginal college grad. She represents a very submissive polarity. There is already plenty of room for sexual attraction there. But then when Mr. Gray turns on his role of master in the power exchange, his dominant energy is heightened. When Anna submits to his will, her submissive polarity is exacerbated, and they both fall madly in lust while the whole world squirms in their seat reading about it. If 50 Shades were the business book of sex, it would be good to great. As with the story, the basic premise of polarity or power exchange is that one partner takes the dominant role and the other takes the submissive role. This is not gender specific, but generally, in a single session, the roles don't switch. There are a lot of toys and props associated with power exchange, but they are just different ways to create the underlying conditions. One doesn't need to get lost in the props. The masterpiece is in the power dynamic itself. In a relationship that struggles with polarity, let's say a couple that has two dominant personalities, both with strong careers and similar characteristics in bed, adding power exchange can be the air that allows the flame of passion to ignite. There are many methods and means by which you can play the game, but these are the basic strategies. 1. Delayed gratification. The submissive delays gratification at the request of the dominant. 2. Restraint. The submissive is physically restrained or encouraged not to move certain body parts, hands, feet, etc. 3. Pain. The submissive endures trials of light to moderate pain at the request of the dominant. 4. Observation. The dominant can observe the submissive for longer and more explicitly than the submissive. Not only might power exchange ignite additional passion, it might just be one of the keys to mental health. In a survey of 66 dominant females, they described the services they provided for their partners as therapeutic. In a fascinating 2006 study, researcher Pamela Connolly compared power exchange practitioners to the normal population and found that practitioners had lower levels of many negative characteristics, including depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and paranoia. Basically, they were chill as fuck. A study 7 years later by Andreas Wischmeier and Marcel Van Assen found something similar. This time about traits that, frankly, all of us would like to have more of in our lives. Practitioners were more extroverted, more open to new experiences, more conscientious than their non-practicing counterparts. Practitioners were also found to be less neurotic and rejection sensitive. Now, you don't need to go turning your bedroom into a BDSM dungeon overnight, nor should you do anything that your partner isn't open to. but you should experiment. You should release some of those inhibitions. Build on some of those communication skills we just talked about and tell your partner what does and doesn't turn you on. One of the more striking things from research about sex and power exchange communities is how easily and often they are able to get into the flow state, a state of mental transcendence. In the words of Ron Burgundy, it's science. So if you've toyed with the idea of trying any of this, but found it too taboo because of cultural stigmas or your own hang-ups, let that stuff go and give yourself a shot at better sex. You might find you have the perfect capstone to your day. Better skill. I have very little interest in being a sexual golf pro and coaching you on your strokes, so I am not going to waste your time running down a bunch of techniques that you can find in other books and Cosmopolitan magazine articles about driving that special someone crazy for days. Instead, what I want to offer you is a single skill that both women and men can employ, and that can bring a disproportionate amount of pleasure compared to the effort it requires. It's all about mastering the squeeze. For a man, purely physical sexual pleasure comes down to friction. Controlling the rhythm and pressure of the friction during intercourse is a skill that women, especially, are able to practice by squeezing the muscles of the pelvic floor. First discussed in the published research of an American gynecologist named Arnold Kegel in 1948, these exercises eventually took his name. A Kegel, as it is called, is a contraction of the pubococcygeal, PC, muscles, which is pretty much what you do to stop yourself from peeing midstream. If a woman can master the contractions of the PC muscles during intercourse, she can vary the friction to speed or slow the climax, taking the vagina from purely passive participant to pulsating pleasure pocket. For men, the goal of the squeeze is something different. Training the PC muscles has been shown to increase the hardness of erections. The control of contractions works as a kind of pump to increase blood flow through the shaft. But the real magic happens when a man is able to use this skill to indefinitely delay ejaculation. The problem with a male orgasm is that it usually only happens once, and if it happens too soon, it can leave a partner unsatisfied. Mainstream advice for men is pretty simple. Think about baseball, the idea goes. Yeah, right. If you can think about baseball while a sexy woman is moaning and writhing underneath you, using her own PC muscles to play with the friction, you are either a sociopath or a salary cap data geek like the guys from Moneyball. Better methods for orgasm control are required. The way I see it, you have three choices. The first choice is simply, when you are getting close, to slow down or stop. Shift your focus to oral or manual stimulation for your partner, and then restart when the engine isn't quite so hot. This is basic brinksmanship, as the terminology goes. Or you can take manual control of the PC muscles that actually control the ejaculation and keep them contracted so that they are unable to activate the launch sequence to release the ejaculate. It will take some time to build up the strength to execute, but the payoff is worth it. It carries very much the same pleasure of the orgasm, but without the release, and there is still the same biological urge to continue having sex. For those looking for a Kegel training regimen, check out the app Kegel Camp. Otherwise, practice 3-second contractions in sets of 10 as often as you think about it. As you advance, practice holding the contractions longer than 3 seconds. In the meantime, while you build up your Kegel strength, there is a third method that can accomplish something similar. The million-dollar spot. The legend goes that a man who struggled with premature ejaculation paid $1 million to a Taoist sex master to learn of a spot he could press on his body to manually prevent ejaculation. This probably never happened, but the spot is not a myth. It's your perineum, located between testicles and anus, and its contractions are what propel the ejaculate forward. By applying manual pressure with 2 fingers to this spot, you can delay or prevent the ejaculation. When you do Kegel exercises, this is the spot you're strengthening. Sure, it feels weird, But remember, no one can see you practicing. After a few years of practicing your Kegel contractions in the car, you may be able to delay ejaculation the way you take a cell phone call in that same car, hands-free. Better physical performance. Sexual performance is both a physical and a mental game. We've already talked about some of the psychological factors that can interfere with sexual performance, but when it comes to the physical aspect, it's all about making sure that the blood is going to flow where you want the blood to flow. And as we discussed in the last chapter, the chemical that controls that is a molecule called nitric oxide. Nitric oxide affects blood flow to your whole body, including your genitals, by regulating the restriction or dilation of capillaries. More nitric oxide equals more dilation, equals more blood flow. For dinner, we talked about eating pro-sex foods that contain nitric oxide-boosting qualities. And this is why. It's basically natural full-body Viagra, which itself actually works by capitalizing on the local release of nitric oxide during sexual pleasure and enhancing the effects. Based on the research, one could argue that nitric oxide is the key component to your sexual stamina, sexual pleasure, and health. More blood flow to the erectile tissue, penis, clitoris, equals more surface area available for pleasure. It's a pretty straightforward equation. The key is to find and take advantage of ways to increase your nitric oxide intake. Besides eating enriched foods, fresh air and sunlight have been shown to increase nitric oxide. Even laughing or watching funny movies can increase it. Interestingly, watching stressful or scary movies caused a restriction in blood flow, proving that if you're in it for the sex, The Conjuring is not the way to conjure a massive boner. A comedy will always be the best option when you're ready to Netflix and chill. Better mental performance. The brain is the most important sex organ we have, period. If your head isn't in the game, your body is not going to be in the game either. Trust me, I've been there. So how did I get out of my funk? Compassion, both for myself and for my lover. If you see someone you love being really hard on themselves for making a mistake, like missing a shot in a basketball game, forgetting a line in a play, or playing a note off key, what is your response? To make them feel worse about themselves? Tell them how bad they suck? Or is it to have compassion and shrug it off? I can tell you which one yields a better result. Sex is no different than any other performance. If you have an unsatisfactory sexual performance, then treat yourself or your lover the same way you would treat someone in a sport. Have a laugh about it, smile, and don't make it a big deal. If you remove the punishment for failure, you will remove the fear of failure. If you remove the fear of failure, you remove the activation of the parts of the brain you don't want to be activated. The other way to take the pressure off is to expand the definition of what constitutes successful sex. Starting sex off with satisfying oral sex or even a sensual massage ensures that the experience will be pleasurable beyond the simple act of intercourse. In short, it takes the pressure off the things that are hardest to control, namely erections and vaginal wetness. Last, just as with any sport, the key is to be in the moment. When I coach a fighter, like the great Cody Garbrandt, on the mental aspects of a great performance, I tell him to be in the moment. Feel the canvas beneath his feet, the energy of the crowd, and don't think about anything in the past or future. Just be there in the big now. It's the same with a lover. Focus on the smells, the sounds, the feeling of it all. Don't think about what is going to happen in 5 minutes or what happened 5 minutes ago. Just be there. That's all you got to do. Prescription. More sex, better sex. That is both the prescription and the goal. Simple enough, right? Hopefully, what we've just spent the last few minutes talking about will help you own the bedroom on your journey to owning the day. To help you get over the hump, here are a few other things you can do. Open up and try one new thing. If you have a regular sexual partner, the first intercourse you need to focus on is with your mouth. You gotta talk. Create a space where you can discuss openly anything that is on your mind. your fantasies, your boundaries, your motivation, everything. Then mutually make a decision to help each other get better. Experiment, push the boundaries, gently or not. Get out of your comfort zone, but always be ready for feedback. Great lovers aren't born, they are made out of good listeners. Besides, there is nothing you can implement from this chapter without the consent of your partner. So talk about it. Talk about what you read. Talk about the studies. Maybe they can listen to the chapter themselves. Then every time you talk, make a plan to try something new. Could be something little. Could be something big. When it's done, communicate how it went, how it felt. This can become a really exciting part of your sex life and certainly lead to more, better sex. Take pornography fasts. The first time I took an intentional pornography fast was at age 34. That meant I had pretty much 20 straight years of occasional porn with a few weeks here or there when I accidentally lost access. Not any different from most guys I know. The reason I took the fast was unrelated to anything having to do with sexual optimization, however. It was part of a spiritual practice. The task was to go 21 days without thinking a sexual thought. No fantasies, no masturbation, no sexual contact, nothing. I wasn't even supposed to dream about sex, but on the 18th day, my unconscious mind disagreed with me. I had a wet dream. A grown man having a wet dream. I just started laughing at myself in the morning. In any case, on day 22, when Whitney picked me up from the airport, I was enraptured. Our connection crackled with electricity. Every piece of her skin was tantalizing, every smell intoxicating, and the touch? Forget about it. When we made it to the hotel room, barely, it was one of the best sexual experiences of either of our lives. We still think about that day now, years later. So based on that experience, I'll regularly fast from all sexual images and thoughts. Sometimes just for a few days, sometimes a week. Just as fasting from sugary foods helps bring out the sweetness of all food, fasting from overly indulgent sexual imagery helps bring the excitement back to all sexuality. It is the ultimate weapon against hedonic tolerance, and I highly recommend it. My only advice is to make sure that you can set a goal you can keep. Be realistic and stick to it. Start with one day if you have to. Start with 6 hours if 24 hours feels like an eternity. Build upon your successes rather than complain about your failures. And remember, the fast is just going to make the feast all that much better. Every day for a week challenge. Here is something simple that puts it all together. Have sex every day for a week, each day trying something new. You are going to fast from all other forms of pornography and just focus on your partner. If you run out of ideas, read a good book on sex or listen to a sex podcast. See what happens and tell your friends. We aren't going to make this world a sexier place all by ourselves. If we want more, better sex, we need to include more people and help them be better too. Now do it. When I was thinking about what holds people back from having better sex more often, one word kept rising to the surface. Ego. The biggest obstacle to improving your sex life is the ego. Think about it. When we're single, the reason we don't talk to more potential mates is that we are afraid of rejection. Or sometimes we choose the wrong mate because of our ego. We choose people we are not compatible with because their status or attractiveness will make us feel better about who we are and maybe make others think better of us too. In relationships, we don't ask our partners what they like because even the idea that we aren't already exactly what they want is too much for our fragile ego to handle. The ego leads us to believe, sometimes consciously and sometimes not, that we were born as the kings and queens of all sexual performance. Of course, this only leads to all of us walking around terrified of not performing. We are afraid of how we look, or smell, or taste, because the ego has wild expectations. We might not even admit to ourselves that we are not having as much sex as we should, because the ego doesn't want to admit our sex life needs some help. We might lie to ourselves about our addiction to pornography. We might be seeking high-risk, low-yield sex to unhealthily fulfill an emotional need. All things the ego will brush over, bury, or rationalize away. The truth is this. The ego likes to hold us to an unrealistic standard of perfection. It is always thinking about what happened in the past or will happen in the future. Well, guess what? Sex isn't perfect. Not our genitals, not our partners, not us, and not the act. Sex is sweaty, messy, constantly changing, and happens only in the now. It's different every time, and that very uniqueness is the beauty of the act itself. Tell your ego to back off. Tell it that sex is not who you are, it's just what you do. So relax, take the pressure off, and get back to having fun. Open up all your sensations and perceptions. Don't rush anything. Communicate, broaden your scope of sexuality, and make a promise to yourself that no matter what happens, you won't think less of yourself or your partner. It might be a hard promise to keep, but if you do, I promise it will keep you hard. It just takes practice. The kind of practice that even Allen Iverson wouldn't complain about. Three pointers. The tongue is the most important sex organ on the body, not because you lick with it, but because you communicate with it. Let down your ego. Talk to your partner about your likes, dislikes, and fantasies. Laugh if something you didn't expect happens. Don't take it too seriously. Your sex does not define you. If you enjoy your sex, you are going to have more of it. The more sex you have, the healthier you will be. Limit your indulgence in pornography. Explore power exchange. Be adventurous and level up your sex game by mastering the squeeze. Ensure you are creating favorable sex conditions by supporting hormone balance and managing nitric oxide. Remember that sex begins with attraction, and attraction begins with the nose. So be careful with masking your natural smells and pheromones. Chapter 14. Turn off, tune in. The cell phone has become the adult's transitional object, replacing the toddler's teddy bear for comfort and a sense of belonging. Margaret Heffernan. You have to unplug to recharge. This is going to sound easy, but it might be harder than you think. Your phone has become an extension of you, so for some of you, doing this is going to feel like cutting off your own hand. I don't care. It has to be done. Then you can download your thoughts onto the pages of a journal and really unwind before heading to sleep. This is the opportunity to give a gift to your mind, body, and spirit. The chance to take a deep breath and relax. Getting owned. What's the longest stretch you can remember going without your phone? And I don't mean without phone service, I mean without the physical object. Without that little glowing rectangular box of magic and infinite wisdom. I'll bet the answer isn't something you're proud of. Don't worry, you're not alone. Everywhere I go, I see people super glued to their devices. I see moms on their phones while their kids are screaming at each other. I see people on phones at concerts, the theater, even the movies. FYI, there's a massive screen right in front of you. Put down the tiny one. I see people on dates who are more interested in the screen than in the human sitting across from them. In the bathroom at the airport or the bar, I see guys with a tighter grip and a deeper focus on their phone than on their shaft, unaware of the piss splashing off the urinal and onto their shoes. I am a very busy person, but I have neither sent nor received an email in my life that couldn't wait for 30 seconds and a hearty shake. When these devices went from something that makes life more convenient to something we need to use even while relieving ourselves, I don't know. But whenever the shift happened, it happened completely. We are now a different species because of our devices. We are slaves to them. They own more of our attention than nearly everything else in our lives. Studies show that most of us check our phones between 50 and 75 times a day. Other than breathe and blink, I don't do anything that many times in one day. Our phones have invaded our psyches. Watching the power display on our screen drop into the red produces something called low battery anxiety. People who are afraid, literally afraid, to be without their phones have been diagnosed with nomophobia. A recent study showed a correlation between self-described addictive phone and internet use and anxiety plus depression scores. These are real things. Joe Rogan calls it the spell of the glass. We've become enchanted, bewitched, seduced by the pull of the screen. Even if it all seems somewhat shocking, in one way, it makes complete sense. We are walking around with the most advanced, most sophisticated, best-designed Pez dispensers in human history. That's right. You have in your pocket a device designed to release your brain's favorite chemical candy, dopamine. Your brain can't get enough of this stuff, and your phone is right there to give it to you. Dopamine, or the reward chemical, is released not only when we receive communication from a friend or social validation, but also simply from the act of self-disclosure. A recent study showed that self-disclosure, talking about yourself or posting about yourself on social media, releases dopamine powerful enough to override even financial incentives. In other words, there are actually people out there who, given a choice between banking a stack of cold hard cash and posting a selfie of cold blue steel, would really have to think about it first. It would be all well and good if the phone was just pumping you full of dopamine all day, but as all of us know, the phone has its own cost, ranging from the real to the metaphysical. Phones are stopping us from feeling that full range of emotions that makes us human and helps us to know ourselves, because they take us out of those moments and thrust us into the whirl of information. And if that weren't enough, they're also giving us a heaping helping of dopamine's evil twin, cortisol, the stress hormone. Check your email right now and you'll feel it. That knot in your stomach. That twitch in your back. The sudden hit of anxiety about that deadline that's right around the corner. You know how it feels. Your face scrunches up, your breath shortens, and before you know it, you are pulled into the thick of work, even if you're thousands of miles from your office. The data on this is, at this point, irrefutable. The longer one spends on email in an hour, the higher stress levels are. To be fair, stress has a purpose. Along with its cousins adrenaline and norepinephrine, cortisol makes you more equipped to handle a temporary challenging situation. But should we really let ourselves count email on that side of the ledger? Even if there isn't a stressful email waiting, the act of checking can increase stress. And that's what you have instant access to when you have your phone nearby. You have a ticking stress bomb in your pocket that is quite literally designed to create the opposite conditions for sleep, which is where we are headed ultimately in our day. I've started to think about phones the way bad guys in faraway places must think of drones. They are always lurking there, the dull background hum of our lives, hovering everywhere we go, ready to strike. We can't ever escape them. They have eyes on us wherever we go. We pay a huge cost in never turning the phone off. And the cost is we never turn our brains off, at least not fully, in the way they were designed to be. A lot of us start the day and end the day with the screen in our face, blasting us with information, entertainment, people, problems, and all of life's complexities. As hard as it is to imagine, it wasn't always this way. I remember when the phone was used for a simple purpose, connect two people so they could hear the sound of each other's voices. I didn't have a damn library in my pocket, so the actual library was interesting. I wasn't able to read the news constantly, so I enjoyed talking to people who read the paper. I remember having to actually fill those moments of boredom or aloneness with my own creativity. But yeah, I had to print out maps to go places. You could try and meet up with a friend somewhere and never find her. You could actually get lost. The phone and the connectivity it enables is both a luxurious and futuristic convenience, as well as an annoying and addictive leash. It's not just phones either. It's televisions, laptops, wearable devices, iPads. In the war for our time and attention, these devices have all established their beachheads and created so much static in our lives that many of us find it impossible to separate the signal from the noise. So what do we do? I know it's much easier to say, go ahead and turn off those devices, killer, than it actually is to do it. But we have to try, which is why we're going to start small, with the evenings. We're going to treat these times and the people with whom you share them as a special kingdom, and the devices to which you have been tethered until now will be the barbarians at the gates. It will seem deceptively simple at first. Yeah, Aubrey, I get it. Off switch. Awesome. Roger that. But I would bet some decent money that when you start this process, you'll go through stages of withdrawal. I'm not saying you'll get the shakes and tremors, but I think you'll be surprised with how intense the pull of these devices is. Regardless, I know you can defeat them if you want to. We're here to show you that it's worth it. Owning it. I am a realist. Asking too much is akin to asking nothing at all. So go for it. Revel in that last spell of the glass. Soak in that last hit of dopamine as you refresh your Facebook feed, post your last Insta story, and soak in the last drip of cortisol as you check your email. Because you are now about to unplug. The drawbridge is going up. It's nighttime, and it's time to turn it all off. Power down the laptop. Go ahead, put your phone on airplane mode, DND, or simply shut it off. If you want to keep your phone on but minimize the chance of getting distracted, look into apps like Inbox Pause from Boomerang. This will ensure you don't have any late-night stress wormholes to get dragged into. However you do it, this is important. We need to clear the static from your mental channels and reduce your anxiety load. You have a big day tomorrow. You have to own it. You can do it. It's a phone. Your life doesn't depend on your next email, and if you think it does, then I recommend you put this book down and tend to whatever that email says. If that email didn't help, spoiler alert, it won't. Then use your mental override practice or just think how exciting it will be to check in with all your social friends and work puzzles in the morning. Either way, it's got to be done. Then you can move on to the stuff you should be doing to wind down before sleep. But I get it. You're saying to yourself, but Aubrey, I've turned it off. And all I can do now is think. Sit here and think about this and that. And I want to write stuff down, do stuff, because I want to be a baller like Gary Vee. I hear you. But part of making sure you own each day is giving your brain time to recharge its batteries. We extend the same courtesy to our devices, don't we? We plug them in so they can get full again. Your brain needs the same thing. I know that the first few evenings you do this will feel funny. It will feel so automatic to reach for your phone and cycle through news or Facebook or Instagram. It'll feel unfamiliar to just sit. So let me offer some suggestions for what you can do to fill that time and charge your batteries. Journaling. I try to journal every night. My process has two parts, both of which should fit on a single page. I start by writing down my mission and three main objectives for the following day before then carrying on to more cathartic or freestyle journaling. Your mission should be as simple as own the day. Or make everyone around me happier. Whatever it is, writing it down gets it out of the hamster wheel of your mind and makes it real. It is a reinforcement of the overarching objective of your life. Writing things down also reduces the instinct to go over that thought again and again in your head, making it easier for you to relax. Knowing that you won't forget anything because it's written down right there in front of you also smooths your transition into sleepy time and makes waking up to own the day a pleasure instead of a panic. The Objective Law of Three. Like a lot of young, ambitious, entrepreneurially minded founders and CEOs, I can very easily find myself with a Google Calendar that has no white space in it for days at a time. My instinct with each success is to seek out another one, with each failure to try again twice as hard. If I'm not careful, I can end up with more balls in the air than a troop of all-male acrobats. The problem with that isn't the stress of it all, though stress is definitely an issue. It's that I can only ever do three things well at a time. This fundamentally violates one of my core principles, do it well or not at all. Yet here we are. To help myself stay truer to that principle, I started a practice of limiting myself to listing three objectives for the following day, laid out right below my mission at the top of the journal page. Ideally, these objectives are mission-related, but even if they're not, even if they include minor tasks like finish errands for the party, thinking of them as submissions or mini-missions will help imbue them with the significance they need for you to get your hustle on and get them done. Why three? I detest all forms of numerology, but three really is the magic number when it comes to our ability to focus, whether we're operating at a micro level or a macro level. Research on working memory, for example, pegs the sweet spot for the number of things we can hold at once in our conscious at three or four. And since we're not trying to stretch the elastic limits of your brain as you wind down toward bed, three is square in the center of the bullseye. It's why at the end of each chapter we have limited our pointers to three, and why fellow health and fitness CEO Josh Bazzoni abides by the law of three in his own life, only allowing himself to focus on three things at the same time. Maybe that's why he grew his company to twice the gross sales of Onnit in half the time. He was doing less, not more. The question isn't whether he could handle four or five objectives. Of course he could. The question is, at what point do you start sacrificing your greatness for goodness? Cathartic writing. If you look back at my journals, you would think that I was a very troubled individual. The reason is a normal one, though. I journal the most when I'm going through something difficult. I think that would be true for most people who journal regularly. The first instinct of most people who are surfing through life on a rainbow of unwavering love is to share their joy with the world, not the blank pages of their journal. The beauty of writing, especially in a place meant only to be read and reviewed by you, is that it allows you to organize your thoughts and make sense out of the nonsensical. In this sense, journaling has allowed for pure, unfettered catharsis that has also allowed me to indulge myself in the creation of a lasting monument to my emotional pain. Not only does this give me a running tally of all the things, both external and internal, that I have overcome on my path toward success, but just as writing down my mission gets it out of my head and makes it real, writing down my pain gets it out of my head and confines it to the page, which makes it much more manageable. It's like a Ghostbuster trapping a ghost in that little box and storing it in the warehouse. Research backs up this sentiment. People who engage in expressive writing report feeling happier and less negative than they felt before writing. Other depressive symptoms like rumination and anxiety tend to drop after writing about emotional upheavals as well. Channel your inner poet and let your emotions fly. They've used up enough of your mental batteries already as it is. Caveat, sacred ground. In ancient times, trespassing on sacred ground was punishable by death. I think that's a little harsh for putting your boots on a piece of dirt. But when it comes to journals, I kind of like the old rules. Reading someone else's journal is a violation of the deepest intimacy. It is a psychological rape. It is not only a betrayal of the past, but also a betrayal of the future. The moment you are journaling with the worry that someone else might read it, your journal is worthless. It has fallen victim to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's just not the same anymore. If regular invasion of privacy is a possibility in your relationship or household, I recommend using a secure password-protected file system on your computer. The best way to do this is to create a separate email address on Gmail and use the Google Drive feature for your journaling. Your email will not be in use, and so the likelihood of it being hacked is almost zero, plus even if someone did, they wouldn't know whose journal it was. Enjoy cuddle time. Cuddle is the time before bed that should be the most stress-free of your entire day, where you spend time with people you care about most, even if that's just yourself. You've owned the day. You've set out your mission and objectives for the following day. And now let's let that stress and cortisol hit the floor. You're off duty. Act like it. If you have a special someone in your life, now is the time to get close to them and do stuff together, sans phones. If you don't, it's time to get to know and to treat yourself better. The golden rule isn't just for other people. After all, you count too. Non-video gaming. Let's say you have a competitive nature and need a little more stimulation. Go old school and pull the board games and card games out of the closet. They turn your brain to something challenging, but in the context of social interaction with real human beings, instead of stressful digital combat that defines the blue light-dominated phone and computer screens we cling to. I love chess and Monopoly when I want to ignite my strategic fire. When I just want to laugh, I whip out Cards Against Humanity. And when I want to let my nerd flag fly with my nerd brethren from the multiverse, it's Magic the Gathering all the way. Planeswalkers for life, dog! The Tube. A study by Australian researchers showed that every hour of watching television after age 25 was associated with a 22-minute reduction in life expectancy. When it comes to shows like Westworld or Girls or Billions or Game of Thrones, I'll take that trade. Plus, it's off the end of my life, and that's like really far away. Some television is too good to ignore or to pretend it's not culture. Like everything, it's all about balance. So when it comes to your favorite show, cuddle up with your own Mother of Dragons or King in the North and enjoy the fuck out of it. Just don't try to manage your anxiety or mitigate your guilt by having your laptop open, pretending to stay productive. That defeats the whole purpose. As for video or computer gaming, games are designed to be highly stimulating, engaging all your attention through heightened stress and focus. Not really ideal before bed. Find another time to pwn your friends. Headshot, bitch! Reading. This one isn't too complicated. Reading books is one of the fastest way to give yourself over to another world, another time, and level up your mind. It literally allows you to stand on the shoulders of the giants who came before you. We live in a world where there are near infinite books and less time. So it is important to choose the right books for your mood and your mindset. Personally, I don't read a lot of business books because they tend to take an idea you could cover in 5 pages and expand it into 200, with anecdotes and platitudes and truisms that I've already read 100 times. Instead, I prefer books built on philosophical or spiritual topics, because that is the headspace I deliberately put myself in as I wind down my day. I would never abandon fiction, of course, and when I do dip my toe in the pool of history's greatest imaginations, I almost always get the most out of the classics, with one exception. The American writer Cormac McCarthy. He's probably the best writer I've ever read, including all the greats. I remember immersing myself in The Road and realizing as I closed the back cover that the entire story was a setup for one perfect paragraph on the last page. And damn, was it worth it. But that's just me. You might be different. Just know that there are no wrong books if you like them. The only rule you should follow is that if you start a book and you don't like it, do not continue to read it just because you bought it. Life isn't the summer reading program at your local library. You don't get free passes to the water park just for finishing books, even if you hate them. The surest way to avoid having your reading time wasted is to lean on the recommendations from smart podcast guests and your own bookworm friends and mentors. Most of the best books I have read came to me through those channels. Books I didn't just read cover to cover, but inhaled and then sifted like I was searching for gold on the Bering Sea. Reading's been so important to my personal growth that I take the responsibility of recommending books to people very seriously. I keep 5 copies of my 10 to 12 favorite books in my office cabinets at all times to give to just the right person at just the right time. Giving a book that doesn't get read is a waste. Giving a book that gets read but doesn't help is even worse. Optimize your personal care. Brushing your teeth, flossing, washing your face, stretching and rolling out your muscles, taking a bath. Historically, for many of us, these actions have always felt like obligations, duties forced upon us by parents and doctors back when we were kids and we had no choice. And now that we're adults, if we do them, we do them begrudgingly and hurriedly. What a colossal mistake. These things are not nagging chores. They are opportunities to clear out the junk, make yourself feel better, arm yourself for tomorrow, and reward yourself. Sure, there's nothing sexy about floss, but there's also nothing better than the feeling of breaking up the tight muscle fascia in your back and your legs than giving yourself some time to take that long soak in a magnesium-rich Epsom salts bath that you've been dreaming about all week. Even better, none of these things involve screens, but they can involve a partner, making them even more enjoyable. Take my word for it. There is no better time than the period between dinner and bed for some honest-to-goodness restorative me time or we time. Caveat: what goes on your body gets in your body. The skin is not made of aluminum. It is porous and designed to conduct molecules both into and out of the body. One recent study determined that laboratory skin absorption rates are generally underestimated, and that the skin contributes a good portion of contaminants that enter our body. And different parts of the skin have different absorption rates. Some of the most absorbent areas are the gums, genitals, and armpits, with rates as high as 99%. So take precautions with your personal care regimen. Your teeth whitener doesn't just whiten your teeth and then you spit it out. It enters the bloodstream and tries to whiten your liver. The metals in your deodorant don't just change the smell of your skin, they try to deodorize your whole body. That petroleum-based lubricant isn't just helping your good parts slide, it's putting dead dinosaurs into your joints. The bottom line is this: if you wouldn't eat it, you shouldn't put it on or in your body. This is especially true for the penis and vagina, which have a layer of microorganisms that are the first line of defense, protecting your special man and lady parts. You want to do as little as possible to disrupt the balance. For women, remember that your vagina is a self-cleaning oven. Do not use antibiotic or perfumed soaps and douches. Some studies have shown that these types of products increase your chances of infection. Instead, use all-natural products like unscented Castile soap and aloe vera-based lubricants to keep the machinery moving. And as for tampons and pads, they aren't just cotton, they also emit chemicals like styrene, chloroethane, and chloroform. That's an average of 11,400 times that a woman who uses tampons might expose herself to toxic chemicals. Styrene, a neurotoxin, is listed by the World Health Organization as a carcinogen, and while chloroform isn't like what we see in the movies where one sniff of a soaked rag knocks someone unconscious, it isn't exactly good for us either. What's worse, because they are listed as medical devices by the FDA, they don't have to list their ingredients. Without testing, there is no way to know what is in your tampon or pad. Bringing the natural tampon game to the next level with Apple-quality packaging is a company called Cora, and many other great natural brands like Lola can be found online. Prescription. There are four essential steps to the restorative wind-down period prior to sleep. 1. You gotta check out and turn off your phone and email so you can check in with yourself and the ones you love. 2. You gotta open up your journal and get your mind off the hamster wheel that creates the mental static and anxiety that prevents so many of us from owning our days. 3. You gotta enjoy the cuddle huddle. Playing, watching, reading. 4. You gotta brush your damn teeth and soak your damn bones. Here is how that looks for me. I'll check my social platforms to make sure all is in order and people aren't reaching out telling me the website is broken or an unusually high percentage of people aren't telling me that I suck for some reason. All right, and also because my social media usually is really positive and it feels good. Then I'll check my emails, not to respond, but to star the ones I need to get to in the morning. Then I'll check my texts and see who I ignored through the day and decide if I really need to answer them. Texts are like the new email. The more you respond, the more you get back. So don't feel compelled to respond to everyone. We all need to just get over it. Sometimes you aren't going to hear back from someone, and it's not because they don't love you. Then I'll bust out the journal, rewrite my mission, and figure out what my 3 objectives are for the following day. If there is anything else on my mind, I'll write about it then and there, too. I'll brew up a tea. Ron Tea Garden Longevity Tea, Tulsi Sweet Rose Tea, or Republic of Tea Milk Thistle. Sometimes it's a reishi mushroom latte with 4 sigmatic reishi and vanilla emulsified MCT oil. Then generally I'll jump into something I enjoy, a TV show, a game, or something else fun that is not too high energy. After that, I'll handle my personal care, shower, and as I wait for the sleepies to come, I'll start reading in orange light controlled by color bulbs, Philips Hue, or in a pinch, the nerdiest biohack of all, blue light blocking glasses. When the sleepies hit, out go the lights. Now do it. I've suffered off and on from anxiety most of my life. It feels like there's one of those Tesla electricity balls in my chest, and I can't relax. I don't do my best work under those conditions. And not surprisingly, this happens the most when I fail to turn off the day. Or when I lose sight of my objectives, or if I haven't purged all the emotional static on the pages of my journal. But when I do all those things and still struggle, generally it just comes down to having a little more faith. In my life, I have always overcome the challenges that were presented to me. If you're still here listening to this, that means you have too. In hindsight, I can honestly say that I am grateful for every one of my failures and mishaps. I learned something valuable from all of them. I became stronger, wiser, better because of them in some way. With hindsight, I am batting 100%. But sometimes I lack the foresight to see what hindsight was going to tell me. If everything that happens to me is something I am grateful for, why am I so anxious about the future? I've always dealt with the problems that I've needed to deal with. I've always come out better, yet I lack the foresight to have the same perspective as my hindsight. It's just not having faith. It's thinking that this next disaster will be different. Guess what? It's probably not going to be different. Whatever comes, you can deal with it. You will deal with it. Fight that battle if it comes. Until then, do not play war games in your mind and in your heart every night. Find a strategy that works for you and put your stress away, at least for a few hours. This might sound like a very first world problem I'm harping on if you're one of those people who easily gets tired of successful people talking about their struggles and failures, but the reality is that many cultures have strategies for this very problem. In Guatemala, children are given worry dolls that they tell all their concerns to before bed. As keepers of their worries, the dolls act as the stress release, and the child can drift into a peaceful sleep. Native American culture uses the dream catcher to catch any negative energy or spirits so that the sleeper can rest easy. But most importantly, be grateful that life is the kind of chef that doesn't pander to our sweet tooth. It serves up bitter and salty meals that keep us hale and hearty, and every once in a while, it gives us the chocolate cake. You aren't ever going to be able to fully control what's on tomorrow's menu, but everything life has served you so far has made you the person you are today. Own that thought and tell your stress that it can go fuck itself. 3 pointers. If you don't turn off, you won't ever properly turn on. The stress of carrying the weight of the day into the night will compound over time and slow you down. Let your phone go. It will be there waiting for you in the morning, I promise. One of the most effective ways to deal with stress is to pick up a pen or open a Google Doc and start journaling. First, you want to make sure you set your mission and objective for the following day. Then you want to purge anything you no longer want to carry and memorialize those things you don't want to forget but also don't want to burden your psyche with. The last hour before bed is time to really wind down and cuddle with yourself or someone you love. It's the time for reading, a relaxed